All right, so we can start. So, good morning. My name is Umberto Giraudo. I'm a product designer, actually. And by chance, I'm also directing a product design course here in Moscow for British Irish School of Art and Design. I'm in Russia since 2007, so it's almost 5 years. But I'm here, we are doing many projects, and I'm also working very closely with my students. And today, I'm going to be quite provocative, and I suppose that most of you are IT-related people, and I'm going to speak about products. And why I'm going to take into consideration this topic? Well, we will see during the presentation, but first of all, I think that the most important thing is that I think, personally, that very, very soon, I'm going to be jobless. I think that product design, as it is intended, as I was educated myself, doesn't make any more any sense. And why is that? Well, the story is quite long. So in 2007, this guy invented this, he's mostly famous for this lemon squeezer, started to say that product design is dead. That was 2007, that was for an interview for Der Spiegel. And I can understand his point of view. Obviously, he made some very important product, he made some very good advancements in design. And we can see, for example, this chair by which he invented the technology to be able to produce this chair. He was working in very close relationship with that. But if you give a look to his latest products, well, if he can call this a lamp, I'm not really sure. And the actual appearance of that doesn't really look so meaningful and so important as the previous object that he was designing. So this is why Philip Stark started this kind of discussion about what is going on in the field of product design. Certainly, design is something for everyone. Product design is basically every single object that you are having around us. The computer I'm presenting from, the microphone, the bottle of water, the screens, everything is designed by some designer somewhere that makes this product. And the main point of making this product is that it has to satisfy some people need. It needs to be satisfying ergonomics, needs to satisfy functionality, needs to satisfy a lot of several aspects. But what is more important is that basically everyone, theoretically, is capable of designing. But if you give a look to the latest development, to the latest advancement in design, we can see that what we find on blogs, on internet, is mostly this thing. And does this make any sense? Is this really what we call design? Well, if I see this kind of object, what I can say is that Philip Stark was right. Sorry to say that, but this is absolutely bullshit. And the second point is, give a look to this chair. So this is Alvar Aalto, a Finnish designer. He designed chairs and invented a second technique by bending wood in 1930s in Finland. So this was his chair. Then around 1956, so 1960s, there was Charles Eames. And he also made use of his technique and he developed some kind of language. But why is this happening in 2012? For God's sake, it's 80 years. And 80 years, we are still talking about bloody wooden chairs. And this is the main point, because there is a cultural crisis going on in design. And this is the way it's affecting the products and the understanding that we all have about product design. So, design initially was developed and was studied to become democratic. Design had a very incredible development across the Second World War, so 1930s and then 1950s. And why was that happening? Because people were becoming more and more wealthy, especially after the war, and they had no supplies. Not everyone could afford to have a sofa. Not everyone could afford to have a coffee machine and so on. And the main purpose of product design at that time was to become democratic, was to supply the basic needs and to supply the best possible products that are guaranteeing safety, ergonomy of use, and also kind of empathic communication with the user. What I'm wondering if it's still making sense to talk today about democratic design. Just give a look to our lives. How many of you are not having a mobile phone? You see? So, hardly, I suppose that any of us is not having any product. We are all surrounded by products that you make use on a daily basis. We all have a sofa, we all have a car, we all have a coffee machine, we all have a lot of elements. And this is a very basic issue about design. So, if initially we were supposed to supply basic needs, and all these basic needs are accomplished, what is then the next challenge? What is going to happen next? Second point is, we all see that there is a very big technological advancement. We all see that technology is permeating our lives and is becoming thinner and thinner. Now, if I take my personal point of view as a product designer and I see this flat screen that is represented in this image, as well as the flat screen that is projecting this image, you can understand that what is left to design there. Basically, this is just a very, very, very thin surface that is like 3-5 millimeters, and the basic design, so-called design, the styling, can be just take place in this point. So, for this reason, what is better to say is, where shall we design the product? Is the product still the TV, or the product is what is inside the TV? And if it is what is inside the TV, whose duty it is? Is it the duty of graphic designer? Is it the duty of programmers? Is it the duty of electronic engineers? Or is it the duty of product designers? And this is what I'm going to discuss today. And what I think that this kind of TV, this kind of product, is starting to face us with challenges is what I call dematerialization. The fact that products are becoming more and more invisible, that products are losing their physical appearance in favor of translating more towards interface, towards different kinds of design. So, what I like as a quotation is the quotation from Paolo Antonelli. Paolo Antonelli is a senior curator of MoMA in New York, especially dedicated to product design area. And she says that designers are going to be the philosophers of the future. And this is interesting. She's not saying that they are going to be the philosophers in the future, but of the future. And this difference is quite important, because she says that designers are going to establish the culture, the background aspect that will define how the society will evolve and what society will be doing in the nearest future. Oh, sorry. So, okay, sorry for ladies. Now it's covered, everything is fine. So, going back to the main aspect, so far we have been saying that product design is about people, it's about the interaction of people. And if we decompose the main aspect of a human person, we can understand that a person is provided by intelligence by which he shapes the reality around himself, and because of that is connected to construction. But to be able to do something, to be able to change the environment, the person needs to be contextualized inside a society, and to be able to create something, he also needs to have energy and health. What I'm going to see with you is some of the latest advancements in very, very different fields of technology to understand in which world we are living today, to understand what are the major challenges, the major changes that are taking place. So, to start with the first one, I'm just reporting very quickly. I don't go too much in detail. You can look for these things on the internet and so on. Quite recently in Cornell University in 2009, they published a paper, and in this paper they started to call the definition of a new model of artificial intelligence. And what do they mean by artificial intelligence? They managed to make a machine that, with some sensors and so on, can understand the reality. And that by understanding the reality, can automatically generate these equations that are describing a certain physical law. And what is more interesting is that during this experimental phase, they managed to prove that this machine was working with existing laws, with existing elements coming from the real world. But at some point, they arrived to the essence that this machine was telling something that the programmers themselves could not understand. So they saw an equation, they saw that the machine provided what is the logical, the algorithm, the law behind a certain phenomenon, but they could not decipher that. And so what they did was to tweak the machine, to tune up this machine in such a way that the machine could tell themselves how this law is based and what is the meaning of what the machine itself is saying. Okay, this is a very basic example. It's obviously very much related to physics, not to the ordinary world, not to our ordinary life. But I think that this is one of the most interesting and important advancements in defining what we call artificial intelligence. For the first time, we are facing the fact that a machine understands more than what we understand. Second point, if you go back to energy, we all know that there's big problems about pollution, about environment, about CO2 emissions. We know that the European Union is setting very stringent rules about CO2 emissions, and a couple of days ago there was a new Kyoto Treaty about these specific topics. What is interesting is that very recently they also discovered a way to convert CO2 directly into fuel. So they managed to design, by interfering with the DNA, some bacteria that are eating CO2 and creating petrol, so creating fuel directly. The third point is the creation of artificial organs. These are some advancements that are taking place, obviously, mostly in the United States, but and there are basically two main directions. So some people are trying to print, to 3D print certain organs, and other people are vice versa, trying to move on DNA level in trying to reuse the stem cells coming from the same body of a person in order to regenerate, to grow up again some organs that were affected by some illness or some specific problems. What is this defining? This is defining that for the first time in the history of humanity, we are trying to defeat death, and we start to become quite efficient in that. For the first time, we can start to think, maybe not now, maybe not in 5 years, but certainly in 10 years, that if our heart or our lungs or our liver we stop working, we can simply replace it. We can simply grow up a new part. The fourth element is advancement of nanotechnology. And why is nanotechnology so important? Because nanotechnology is shifting drastically the paradigm by which we are constructing and developing things. What is interesting is that this kind of theory was first developed in 1986 by Eric Drexler, who wrote this book that is called Engines of Creation. And in this book, he was starting to define the kind of futuristic scenario where factories that are weighing in total 10 kilos can produce 10 kilos of products per day. And what he was mentioning was the fact that for the first time, instead of building by material, adding metal, removing metal, using milling machine, using drilling machine, and all these kind of things, every single part of these atoms, every single part of this pixel can actually be directed intelligently in a smart way to be assembled one on the top of the other. This is why more than nanotechnology used to call it molecular technology. If you give a look to this image of this car is basically 5 micron. So it's 1/10 of the thickness of your hair. And you can see that the definition by which they were building this machine is quite interesting. And again, 3D printing technologies. We all know about MakerBots, Ultimaker, and all these kind of machines. And these machines are becoming more and more interesting, up to the point that even children can start to play with them and also to start to produce their own toys. And if you just saw the first revolution going on with ABS technology, with printing filament of plastic that is melting down, with Formlabs from the United States that got successfully funded on Kickstarter the previous month, we can see that we are starting to face the second revolution, the second wave of more advanced 3D printing that is capable of providing a higher level quality of surfaces and a thinner definition of details. So if we sum up all these details, we can also see that the society that you are living in is very much changed. And this is not just because of Google Glasses or whatsoever, because this is still yet to come. But all of us are having a Facebook account, all of us are having a social network, all of us are living constantly connected to internet. And this is the second point, because in 1984, William Gibson published a book about starting to define and to talk about cyborg. And if you face the reality that we are standing now, more than 30 years later, we can understand that many of these predictions are starting to become real, as well as many of the predictions of Eric Drexler. We start to see that we are changing the world. But what is more important is that, is it really happening, or we are moving towards this kind of model? Are we moving toward an element, kind of lifestyle by which we are constantly connected to internet and we are having a parallel perfect life in the digital world, or vice versa, we are simulating and step by step we are losing our identity in this digital world? And this is the main question that we have to ask to ourselves. And what is important is also to ask to ourselves, why is this happening? What is the law? What is the rule that is defining this kind of change that we are living today? Well, I think that all of you know Moore's Law, that was defined back in 1960s, that was prognosing that every 18 months computational power would double and the price would diminish. And that was quite a linear law. And basically up to 1998, as far as I know, this law has been completely happening. So what he was prognosticating really happened in reality. This is what we faced. But if you give a look to the world around ourselves nowadays, we understand that something more is happening, and something more that is happening is trying to move us from the correct understanding of the world. And why is this? In this case, there are two more authors, that are Venge and Raymond Kurzweil. And what these authors started to define was the law of singularity and the law of recurring invention. And what is more important is that if you start to give a look to these curves, you start to see that these curves are not linear, but they are exponential. And what Kurzweil started to say is the fact that the progress of technology that is permeating our life is not proceeding year by year, but is improving and is diffusing in many different fields. If you give a look back to the examples that I showed you before about growing organs, about bacteria producing fuel, about nanotechnology, about 3D printing, what is the common denominator among all of them? The common denominator is that all these technologies are connected to a computer. And all these technologies are connected to a computer in a way that the development of the software, the calculation power, and so on, is increasing so much that the computer is not just a personal computer, it's not just an office appliance, but vice versa, is going from biology to mechanics to society to economy and many, many different fields. And because of that, this kind of development is summing up together and defining very incredible scenarios of the life we are living in. And this is the main problem that you're facing, because our understanding as human beings is mostly linear. We understand things evolving year by year, but we don't understand things duplicating or triplicating year by year in such a way that you completely lose the sense of what is happening in the world. And quoting back Philip Stark, I think that I agree on one point of the very same interview he released in 1997. Where he was saying that mankind, as opposed to animals, has managed to create civilization based on intelligence. And this diffuse intelligence that computer technologies are offering us on a daily basis is the main key, is the main factor that we should be playing on. And if you give a look to what is happening in design, which kind of intelligence can we see in these things? Basically, there's nothing. This is pure art. It has no connection to the world. It has no connection to what is happening nowadays. And this is why I call it the death of product design, because product design must shift the paradigm, must shift the understanding towards what is the reality that they're living on today. I like very much this sentence. This is one of my favorite designers, Yves Behar. And he said that mentioning Churchill, pessimists are see difficulty in every opportunity, and optimists see opportunity in every difficulty. And I think that this is very much the point, because, okay, we are product designers, we are having a certain kind of education, we know how to realize things that you touch, that you play on. But this doesn't mean that this is the end. We should try to define what is the new beginning, we should try to define what is the new scenario that ultimately will lead to the development of our profession, of our everyday life, and also to the everyday life of the people we are working for when we design products, being these products physical, as we used to know, or digital, or maybe a kind of hybrid between the two. Back to Eric Drexler in 1986, when he was mentioning how can we understand the future, because we are living in a society where everything is possible. So we need to understand what is the algorithm that is filtering what we want to achieve. And these are the three main steps that you should take into consideration when we are developing some strategies, some understanding of the future. And the first one being what is possible, and we start to know by making some research, giving a look around, we can understand what technology is allowing us. But we also need to understand what is achievable. We all know about nanotechnology, but we know that for us personally, at individual level, is not possible in the nearest future, but it will take some time, some 20, 50 years before it will start to spread around the society. But this is the main point that product designers can work around, and this is what is desirable. Because you can have the best possible technology in the world, you can have the most advanced development, but if people are not desiring, if people are not understanding what is going on in the world, then all this is totally useless. It's pure academic or scientific research per se, but it's not connected to the real world. And I think that in terms of development of my profession, or the professional product designer, is very much an issue of the Internet of Things. And as Internet of Things, there is a very big debate going on online. But as technology is permeating every single aspect of our lives, or what is happening around us, we should start to understand how to integrate industry with energy, with people, with public safety, and to try to create some clusters that are connecting elements together. So, if we start to define what is going to be the next scenario, the next thing going to happen, I think that you can divide the main points between content and appearance. Content being what is the kind of physical and tangible appearance of a certain product, and appearance how it looks like, what people perceive about this. And this is a quite interesting image. There is a bar in New York where we are having a very long table with touchscreen interfaces, with a lot of interactive tables where you can sit, have your coffee, and so on. But the picture of this cappuccino and this food in this part are telling us how people are really working. Because people are not just perceiving technology as something to dedicate yourself completely to, but they start to implement their technology, this technology in their daily life, in their daily basis. And they make use of technology in ways that sometimes we would not expect. And this is what is important about the kind of product design education, because we try to understand, we try to observe people. Very often with my students, we send students around with cameras or hidden cameras, spy cameras very often, and we send them into shop. And why do we do that? Because we want to see how people are reacting. Because if you make a questionnaire, you will never get to know what people really need. If you observe a person without this person knowing in the supermarket, and you see how much time he spends in front of the shelves, how much time he spends in reading the text on the products that he's going to buy, you can understand much more. And this is, I think, the very important aspect of understanding how product design can be implemented in this kind of revolution. The second point is that if you talk about content, the content can be divided in three main sectors that are information design. So what is this black box, what is this new device going to do, but also connected to interaction design. So as I'm having this new function, I'm having this new opportunity of this new application, how can I interact with that? Shall it be with buttons, or shall I simply scroll it to make some operations, or shall I throw my phone on the floor so that the application understands that I'm angry if the phone survives, and that I don't want to receive these kind of messages? How shall we interpret that? And this is also about sensorial design, because most of the time, the applications, the digital interfaces they're having are mostly one way. So we provide input information, we receive some visual feedback, but we don't necessarily always receive an understanding from application what we really want to do and how we want to do. Another point is like the one computer per child product that was developed by Yves Behar and Negroponte a couple of years ago. And if we talk so much about the developments of new technologies, we should not forget about people that are leaving behind us. And if you see what has been the impact of this kind of technology in the world, we can see that more and more people from third world countries are starting to connect to internet. And by connecting to internet, they start actually to have something very important to say. And this is also a way that information should connect people. As the new MIT Media Lab director said, we need to make the MIT Media Lab completely an open source. And why is that? Because it makes no sense anymore to say from Boston that we know the very best things about technology, that we can say what other people should be doing. During some of his interviews, he was mentioning people from Zimbabwe or people from Indonesia, they have something very relevant to say. They have something very important. And if you talk about the new academic world in terms of education and development, the education and development should be coming over in a more coherent and more globalized way. And at the same time, we should also not forget about the kind of open source and applications. We all know what has been the great improvement given by Arduino, but I think that this kind of developments are quite halfway through. in the sense that in one way they developed and they open up millions of people that are using these technologies and implementing new sensors and inventing new products, inventing new things. But at the same time, because of the difficulties in programming language, that not necessarily, not everyone can always operate with them. And this is what, for example, we faced with students, because we gave a project with Arduino, and the first 2 weeks it was quite necessary to push them to understand how to cope and how to opt in this direction. And again, also the typical product design process, in the sense that product design, and if we call it design thinking, as it's very much in trying to say, usually is about making prototypes and then developing these prototypes and testing and then reiterating to understand what is a certain scenario by which you operate. And because of that, it's always important to maintain a kind of physical connection to the real world, to understand what people are willing to do with a certain object that we design. And also not to connect just to the graphical interface, not just to what is happening on the screen, but keep on making things. And as very stupid things as this, they can provide constantly a very good understanding of how people will be interacting, what they're willing to do with your digital product. And if you talk about applications, we also see that there is a number of different applications coming to the market. But what is more important is to understand what is the person ultimately thinking about these kind of applications, because most of the times we are having an application for taking pictures, we are having an application for going to the laundry, we are having an application to check the emails, and so on. But are we really using all these applications? Are we really using the 60-plus applications that a typical phone is having on a daily basis? So, and this is my main point, that we should, in any case, always remember to connect back to people and to be very much connected to what reality is asking for and to understand what can we do with this person that is reading a newspaper, what is this woman thinking about, how can we support, how can we design something that is really usable and really tangible. And this is, I think, a very, very stupid example. It didn't have a success. It was a big commercial flop. It came out like 2 years ago. It was a French startup. And they developed this kind of rabbit. And this rabbit is having a computer inside, a web camera, RFID reader, LED, and is also moving the ears. And what is interesting is that this kind of product is defining a kind of hybrid between the two worlds, because you can control this rabbit, carrots, as how is it called, by your mobile phone. And for example, if you put an RFID reader in front of the nose, you can program it in a very easy way, in such a way that you give like this small key holder to your child, and when the child is coming back from school, you can just put it in front of the nose, and this device takes a snapshot, and it automatically sends you an email telling you that your child is back home. Now, what is the real function about that? I don't think that so many people are really interested about that. I don't think that it is going to be, in any case, a commercial success. But what I think is that this is a very good beginning. And what I think is that we should not take into consideration just developing applications, just totally digital interfaces, just caring about what is happening on the screen. But I think that at one point, the market will be so oversaturated, will be so fulfilled by digital products that this overflow of information and communication will be equivalent to nothing. And I think that in any case, we are all having hands, we are all having our own sensorial system, and we should exploit it, and we should take internet out of a screen and back into the physical reality and to understand how we can cope with that. Then, talking about the appearance, Microsoft made obviously a very nice development with this Windows 8 and Windows Mobile, and I agree very much on their point about authentically digital. This is certainly a breakthrough. It's so simple, it's so easy, but we were not thinking so much about that. And if you give a look to the interface of some of their competitors, we can see that most of these interfaces were having this phenomenon called skeuomorphism. Skeuomorphism being the fact that these digital interfaces try to mimic the reality around us, and because of that we start to have wooden backgrounds or rings to simulate a black book, notebook, or simply the pocket like the jeans and so on? And is this really what is necessary? Is this really coherent with the development of the world? Is this really necessary to what the people really need? If you go back to see what the interface that Microsoft Teams has developed, I think it's quite interesting. Very simple, pure graphical design. And I think that to some extent, what this kind of interface means, connected back to the reality, is very much what 3D printing means in the physical world, for designers' world, in the sense that it's defining a very big breakthrough. Because after 10, 15 years that you all got used very much to internet, to the mobile technologies and so on, we start to be ready now for the new development. And the new development being the fact that we can start to shift a bit from physical reality and to start to define new languages and new formal ways of expressing certain content. But ultimately, what is important is simply to make things very simple and very understandable. And in terms of appearance, we all know that there are a lot of tools. We know that we can use heat maps to check where people are looking up with retina tracking display. Or we know that you can use softwares like More from that is tracking the user and is putting some text. Or we know that you can use a different number of technologies. But ultimately, what we really care about is when you buy a product, it's about how the product will look like. If you enjoy this product, if you enjoy the tactility of this product, if you enjoy the colors, if you enjoy the daily emotions. And what is also important is also to maintain a certain coherence in and defining and communicating the new product. This is, for example, a good thing that I saw when I was in Paris back in November. And this was an advertisement of a new Microsoft Surface. And what it was written here was that it's sold without the blue keyboard, and it's available just with a black keyboard. If you want a color keyboard, you need to buy it separately. And but not necessarily all colors are available in all countries. And I think that this is a very big drawback about the product that you see around us. Because what's the sense of selling millions of these devices with two keyboards? Because how many people are really going to use a black keyboard? How many people are really going to enjoy this product with this bright color and instead going to the shop and buy a product that is having a black keyboard and having to spend some $30, $50 more to buy a colored keyboard? And I think that this is another important aspect, that if you define the design of an application, the design of a new digital product, the whole sequence from the concept to the sales should be very much development, and the strategy should be coherent all the time. And especially, as I mentioned before, let's not forget that you're human. Let's not forget that you can use our hands. Let's not forget what are the basic ergonomical parameters that you can make use of on a daily basis. So just very quickly, just to turning page, this is some of the new developments that they're doing with our students. And this was a quite interesting example, because we went to Yandex and we said to Yandex that we, as product designers, we want to do interfaces. We want to see how the developments of a new world are going to happen, because we understand how people are working. Obviously, this project was canceled by Yandex because I cannot understand why product designers are willing to operate in this field. But anyways, we kept on going on and we started to make this project. And the second interesting product is a product done by another student of mine that was back next year. And this product was studied for more than 6 months. So the students make an incredible amount of research trying to understand how to connect the digital reality with the physical reality. And if you think about the amount of folders that you're having on our computer, the amount of files that you're having, but most of the time, if you need to look for something very quickly, if you need to show to a friend of ours the holidays of 2004 when we were in Thailand, we cannot find it. And so this student, Alexander Julin, came up with this idea. This is a kind of RFID color printer that is printing some small text looking like Polaroids. And this text can contain any possible information. So in this information being like a connection to a movie, to a book, to a photos of certain holidays and so on. And the big advantage of this technology, obviously this is just a concept, this is not real, would be that you can simply take and print out a given Polaroid, a given card of your digital content and give it to a friend of yours, and this friend of yours can go to his own Oxu, to his own box, put it on the top of the surface and to access to the same content. So it's basically a way to share and to communicate the digital life that they're having around ourselves. So this is it. If you're having any questions, I'm here. Thank you very much.